Welcome to the Minovate Gang Podcast, episode 270, recorded Saturday, June 28th, 2014. I'm Tim Elliott, and I'm on with Steve Borsch.
Good morning.
Graham Thickens.
Hello, all.
Phil Wilson.
That's actually Steve Bosch.
Stop.
And good our morning. Special super-duper guest host, Julio Ojeda Zapata.
Good morning.
All the way from St. Paul.
And, and his front porch from St. Paul.
His front porch, yeah.
Julio's got a kick butt front porch on his house, so I would be out there too. You know, maybe we ought to do that, guys. Let's just all go to Julio's house and do the podcast. I bet you his wife could make us a really kick butt breakfast too.
She actually would do that, yeah.
I know.
We'd have to probably do it a little bit late though, right? A little bit later than now.
Yeah, we could do that. We could be like WCCO's Go to the Lake. We can go to the porch. Let's just do that. Load up the mics and go to the porch.
Here's the thing, though, is our huevos rancheros, do they do that in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, I think they do that, but when they want to eat Mexican food, yeah.
No, I know, but is there something akin to that? Never mind. I know.
Yeah, it's called pancakes.
Okay, sorry, Steve. I had to give you a hard time.
When we want to eat Mexican food,
well, even though we're in the middle of the summer,
it ain't the same.
it's been a big week for news, so that's why we wanted Julio on to talk about a bunch of the stories, especially coming out of Google I/O and some of the other things. But first, let's get to some local stuff. And Target was in the news. Graham, you sent around this link earlier in the week from the Wall Street Journal, which is sort of like a behind the curtains view of inside Target.
Yeah, it sounded like it was a palace coup
that
happened to force the CEO out. Apparently, they didn't name the actual senior execs that went to the board, but a few of them, I forget if they said it was a few or what, went to the board and said, either he goes or we do.
Yeah, and there was a mutiny coming.
Shortly after that, the board asked Mr. Steinhoffel to head for the door.
Yeah, it's interesting that he had sort of drifted a little off course, and people kind of wanted to pull it back.
Well, off course for the old regime, but not necessarily off course for him. I mean, it's kind of interesting to see that. I mean, that happens all the time when there's a culture shift. You change the guy at the top, and there seems to be a culture shift. And we don't know 100% of what's true and what's sort of been filtered, but yeah, that happens. You know, when somebody has a different idea of how things should be run, it seems like everything was a little bit more freewheeling under the old regime, and it was becoming more of a dollars and cents business. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and a little bogged down in committees and things taking forever to happen. I recall the example they cited of looking at using mannequins in the stores, and it was, you know, taking like months to come to a decision, and they were studying it, and finally, after Steinhoffel left, it's like, okay, let's just do it.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, analysis paralysis was part of the problem, I think. It is kind of what the article implied.
I did find it interesting that that they gave a little credibility to the words Target, because I mean, we've always, that's always been the joke of, you know, running gag, and you call it Target. It's nice to see that they adopted it enough or accepted it enough as vernacular. They incorporated it into their thoughts. So
yeah, right in the headline. Yeah,
right in the headline. So
cheap chic.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, they're continuing to move the business forward, and they have sort of an Amazon-style free shipping offer that's just been clarified this week. So that hopefully that will spark some new business as they try to compete with you know, online and Amazon.
Yeah, anything over $50, except for certain bulky items, mm-hmm. gets free shipping. That's pretty attractive.
Well, one thing that they've done for a while is if you use the red card, you get free shipping anyway. So it's sort of like their version of Amazon Prime.
But the one thing they can't do yet, though, is what Best Buy has finally been able to achieve, which is if you're in looking for something specific, they'll say, hey, hang on a second. Let me see what other stores might have that. And they can look it up instantly online, and they cannot do that at Target.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I ran into that exact situation one time. I was looking for a TV. There was a particular TV that I wanted that Target sells, but they didn't have it at that particular store. And it was kind of a nightmare to try to determine whether that TV was available at a different Target. So at one point, my wife and I, we just threw our hands up and gave up and went over to Best Buy, and the situation there was completely different.
So Julio, one of the things that we've talked about last time was the Amazon's Fire Phone and that new feature that they've put in. What is it called?
Firefly.
Firefly. Do you think that Target and Best Buy are going to really have a problem with Amazon phones out there having that ability to kind of check prices and whatnot? Or do you think it's going to go the other way where they can spur more sales in the store because people have the convenience of looking up Amazon reviews and so forth before they purchase?
Well, what they think is kind of irrelevant and pointless because they can't really do anything about it. If you walk into a store with an Amazon phone, I don't think they're going to be able to control that situation. What they're probably going to do, this is probably going to spur some a spate of development on the app front. With I'm guessing the Best Buy app, Target app, retailers will respond with comparable features, and so I'm imagining that this will lead to some tech innovation on the app front. I'm hopeful anyway.
So we won't be seeing signs, Best Buy bans Fire phones on these premises?
Probably not. Well,
just cross out machine gun and put in Fire phone. Right.
You can do most of that now with the Amazon app anyway on your iPhone or Android phone. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does allow it to be a little bit more convenient, but I don't think it's necessarily cutting edge technology by any means. So, you got to kind of live with it. But as Julio referenced, companies like Best Buy will try to incorporate it in their apps, but I can tell you that we were just talking about this analysis paralysis at Target. I think that Best Buy is kind of in that pool right now too. They take forever to do everything now. So
the flip side is Amazon, hardware isn't really much of a presence. It's just a tiny sliver of the market. So on those grounds, I don't think the retailers are shaking in their boots by any means.
Yeah, not yet anyway.
Not yet, yeah.
Give them a couple of years. One other story that kind of perked my ears up was from one of your colleagues, Julio.
Do you have to share an office with this guy? Good God.
I don't think so. With Joe Soucheray, if you don't know, wrote this column about the an iPad for every kid is just an expensive toy for every kid. A little link bait in that headline. Oh,
just a little, yeah. just FYI, the writers don't write the headlines, but kudos to the link baity copy editor. So.
Well, I will tell you, I read this article and I thought, what a cranky old man.
Yeah, no kidding. This guy's had a bug up his ass for quite some time, hasn't he? Jeez Louise.
Yeah, but that's
while he was taking his streetcar to work.
Yeah, yeah.
You go any faster than 35, the human body. You go to work before, you go faster than 35, you're going to explode.
Well, he's a famous Luddite when it comes to technology. I mean, I listen to a show once in a while when I'm in the car, and they give him crap all the time because he's just been really slow to come to use a smartphone, and they have to give him trouble all the time. I mean, he's even more of a Luddite than Patrick Royce, and
I'm sorry. It just seems like the Twin Cities is loaded with these old cranky bastards between him and Sid Hartman. These douchebags can go away anytime.
He's a little younger than Sid, but
not by much.
But he lives in St. Paul, and I didn't read the whole column, but I assume he doesn't like the idea of the taxpayers having to pay for all this. I suppose, right?
Well,
that the angle here.
Why you can just go ahead and read a book.
Yeah.
Well, he does have a guy who has a newspaper column.
Even though he's a cranky old guy, he does have a point here.
What?
There are other things that maybe are better tools in the classroom than iPads.
Like?
Chromebooks to come up with another thing or Surface tablets. I mean, there's all sorts of different choices out there. It doesn't always have to be an iPad.
I don't think if you put that in front of Joe, it would make much difference to him.
Maybe not.
If it's got electricity, it's clearly bad.
Well, I don't know. Julio, does he type his column in a Tandy 100 or does he use a Mac
probably
or what?
Probably a typewriter.
He mostly files from home these days. I don't see him in the office a ton, but
I think he uses a hammer and chisel. I'm not sure.
I remember, years ago when he kind of ranted about Twitter, he thought Twitter was kind of a big waste of time. And you guys know Chuck Olson, our friendly local filmmaker guy?
Yeah.
He had his Eskimo Witch show at that time, and he did this absolutely hilarious riff on Joe Souchere, and I was on that, and it was hilarious. But Joe's been cranky about this stuff for a long time, so he and I have been at odds often when it comes to technology. I hate to say it in this particular case, though, but I kind of agree with him. he makes one point I don't agree with. He doesn't think the technology itself provides any kind of a learning edge. I disagree with that. I've heard case after case of situations where kids are just inspired to learn when this technology is put in front of them.
That
does happen. But his other point that these are big, shiny, expensive toys, that's a very good point because iPads are very expensive and there are alternatives that are...
Do you have any idea how much school systems spend on textbooks, you guys? Do you have any idea?
Oh, it's a lot.
It's insane.
But the problem is that e-textbooks or whatever the replacement is, apps, let's say on an iPad, those tend to not be any less expensive.
Because the publishing company needs to, prop up an old business plan.
Yeah.
It's going to come down. You've got to give it time. But to not take advantage of every opportunity to educate kids and use technology that's readily available and not invest in it, that's just insane. Is there something better than an iPad or different than an iPad or cheaper than an iPad? Well, of course, we know that there is. But Julio's right. There is research upon research upon research. And it's just common sense. If you can't look at an iPad or look at what's possibly available, the information that you can access with an internet connection, whether it's an iPad or a Chromebook or whatever, and not feel that kids can be inspired more by that, my God, you're just going to be a complete ass.
I agree with you, Phil, because the story that I love to tell, and a friend of mine whose parents were both professors at St. Olaf, and he's an academic through and through. He's a CEO of a scientific curriculum company. And he and I were talking about this at length when the iPhone was introduced in 2007, about how at some point we'll have access to the world's information at our fingertips wherever we are. And so Alex and I are in the car. We're going to school, and he starts asking me questions about what countries are around the Balkan Sea, Dad. And I looked at him, and I said, whoa, wait a minute. Where did that come from? And he goes, well, I was just curious. And I said, no, it's part of your homework, isn't it? And he goes, well, yeah.
And he was answering a quiz question on the radio.
So I handed him my iPhone, and I said, go to Wikipedia and look it up. And he did. And there on Wikipedia was a graphic of the Balkan Sea and had all the countries around it. And so, of course, he's taking notes because he'd forgotten to do this part of his homework. But the point is that having access, instant access, really, to whatever you need and to make associations and all of that, I mean, you really do need technology. Yeah, could you do it with books? Sure. But then you're running back to the Dewey Decimal card catalog and figuring out where the next book is. And, maybe half an hour later, you found the book and you've looked it up, right, rather than 8 seconds later.
Yeah.
And so, there is a lot of especially now that they're flipping the classroom more and more, where they're having the kids watch the videos at night and then coming in the next day. And the teacher's really a coach and a mentor rather than standing up and giving the lecture because the kids have watched the thing the night before.
Well, look, so, I think that there's a lot of things to be said that are positives about, you know, whether it's the iPad in the classroom or the BYOD plans that some school systems are working on, like Lakeville. I mean, there are certain things to be said that you know, we're going to make great advances there. There's also one thing to remember that I don't think everybody that takes the negative stance on, I don't want to invest in technology for my school, they don't keep in mind that it's not replacing, it's augmenting what's being done in the classroom. It's not replacing. If it replaces some of the more social aspects, some of the more artistic aspects and that sort of a thing, yeah, then you've got problems. But this is an incredible tool to augment what goes on in the classroom.
Yeah. And look at you, Phil. Now you don't have to go to the dirty bookstore. You can just look it up online.
Well, that gets it.
I don't do that at school.
Well, you know, that kind of gets into what Suchere, one of his major points is game playing on the things. I mean, look, isn't it conceivable that some kids are going to be spending way more time playing a game? I wonder, do they block the game
of
center
course they
on
do,
these
guys.
Things?
Well, yeah, they only provision
things. Yeah, this isn't like, here's a brand new iPad out of the box. Go ahead and load it up with all your favorite apps. This thing is locked down. It gives you incredible access. So,
and there are also test taking apps that you can actually provision all the iPads at once to only be able to open that app. Or, you know, once that app is open, then the home button doesn't work anymore and so on. So you can't, you know, quit the app and open up Safari and look up the answer in Wikipedia or something. There are lots of tools like that that are really making it a useful tool in the classroom.
Well, and in Joe's defense, he's a technology Luddite. He doesn't know that part. If he knew that, this column might not have happened.
Julio, you got an internal workshop.
Yeah, but my point where I'm sort of aligned with Joe is that I think St. Paul went for this very shiny, very expensive toy. I'm using the word toy used loosely because it is a very useful educational tool. But I worry because there are, I think, better ways. If you base all of this, for instance, on Google Apps, you can deploy mobile devices that are less expensive that have built-in keyboards, but also don't limit you because the iPad is kind of a walled garden. It's sort of whirled into itself. If you're not on the iPad, if you go home and you don't have the iPad, then what the heck do you do? Whereas with Google, you have access to that content, you have access to those tools, regardless of the device. And I think that's a better way. And I've seen the same level of excitement among school kids. I've been in classrooms where kids are just energized about learning using Chromebooks instead of iPads. I don't think iPads alone provide that level of excitement. I've seen Chromebooks do exactly the same thing at a fraction of the price and in a vastly more open tech ecosystem. Yeah, but I'm a big Apple guy, but I personally don't think iPads are the best way to go in the classroom at all.
If you're buying 5,000 devices, you can buy Chromebooks for $150 or less each. So you can get three plus Chromebooks for every iPad.
Well, and Chromebooks used to be crap, but they are getting better and better and better. It's really quite remarkable how they've come along.
Yeah. Well, listen, you know, I think I've made my point fairly clear on how I feel about Apple and education in the past. Clearly, these guys could stand to give discounts and give back a little bit more to the education world that helped build them. You know, that's always bothered me because, you know, I've been very much close to the situation of what kind of prices they charge. Yeah, it's crazy. But at the same time, we can't necessarily throw the baby out with the bathwater saying that, you know, because Suchere's saying iPads are toys. If you put a Chromebook in front of him, he'd say it was a toy.
Well,
so
I don't know.
No, he would. He would say, because it's the same damn thing with a different form feature.
Okay,
that's
what
all.
If you put a legal pad with a number 2 pencil? Would he be okay with that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, of course he'd be okay with that.
Yeah, as long as there was a book that.
Yeah, well, doodle your brains out, kid.
Well, good discussion on that, but let's move on to another story.
No,
Julio
I don't want to.
This week?
I want to beat up on a guy that can't talk back.
I think you're beating the horse too far, Phil. So Julio, our friends at Coco are going up north, North Dakota.
Yeah, I was very interested to hear that because that comes, you know, fresh on the heels of them announcing a big remodel of their St. Paul facility. They have their downtown Minneapolis and uptown facility, and these guys are on a roll. I'm very impressed. They're on the move. I've been impressed with Kyle Coolbrith and Don Pelota for quite a while, and they just keep surprising me. I found it slightly surprising that they, you know, go that far afield to North Dakota, but you know what the heck?
Yeah, why didn't they go to Duluth?
Yeah, I don't know.
An interesting question, but
this was done in conjunction with the folks at Emerging Prairie. Is that what it's called?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
There's a key partnership.
There are partnerships that are always involved in these sorts of things, and there was a partnership involved with getting things started with the Coco Minneapolis location too. So,
well, I would bet that they'll be in Duluth at some point, in St. Cloud, and but you know, it's Fargo's growing like mad, especially with all the oil money that's out there. It's exploding.
Yeah, the entrepreneurial community up there, I've been up there and experienced it. I work with startups that are raising money up there and spend a lot of time up there. I was up there for the with Phil for the mobile conference a month or so ago, and there is just a ton of energy up there. And I don't think there was anything quite like a co-working place up there. Now in Duluth, there's a fairly successful one called CoLab that's doing quite well. But I think it's fair to say there's nowhere near the entrepreneurial energy and money funding early stage startups in Duluth as there is in Fargo. So it was a natural in my mind, but it is far afield from the Twin Cities, that's for sure. But, you know, they'll hire local staff up there, and I'm sure it'll go very, very well for them. It's not that far away. I think it's a logical place to be.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Julio.
I just generally think the co-working thing is very cool. I'm not the kind of person to normally take advantage of that situation. I just like to be holed up in my home office like the introverted nerd that I am. But
yep. Me too.
But I went to quick story. I went to Coco uptown the other day to sit in their theater and watch the Google I/O thing and, you know, munch on some pizza and drink some pop. But then, you know, something popped unexpectedly at work, and so I very effortlessly segued over to one of their little work areas there and sat down with my laptop and, you know, started pounding away on it in this very cool bunker-like surrounding. And I was just sitting there, you know, working and feeling energized and thinking, man, this is really cool because you're surrounded by all of these people doing their thing. And it's just kind of a fun kind of a situation to be in. I really like it.
Yeah, I do too. I think
All I was going to say was I'm going to have to check out that CoLab because I'm up here in Two Harbors. And I will tell you one piece of good news. And Julio, you wrote about this in terms of the LTE expansion. Uh-huh. And in this cabin that I'm in, which is about, I don't know, maybe 5 miles south of Two Harbors, I could barely get one bar with AT&T before, and now it's two, sometimes three. And my Verizon LTE connection, I've only got two bars on my iPad, but I'm getting 40 megabit per second down and 8 megabit per second up on average.
Wow.
Great.
So it's phenomenal.
Yeah, but I think we should also say that today's podcast and Steve's participation in the podcast is brought to you by his neighbor Doris today. So, because that's whose Wi-Fi he's plumbing onto right now.
It's early on a Saturday morning, and I want to thank Doris if she's listening
for not locking down her internet.
That reminds me of something that happened yesterday. I was I got a Verizon phone, and I was like sitting at my desk in my home office and say, "Hey, I'm going to try testing the Verizon LTE versus the AT&T LTE." And so I started doing some speed tests, and I was like, I was shocked on the AT&T side. I was getting these 50 megabit downloads consistently. It was like, I was amazed that I did test after test, 50 megabits. Wow. And then I noticed, I have the Wi-Fi on.
Yeah.
So I tweeted that out with a video of Emily Latella, you know, never mind.
Yeah. Hey, another story that was in the news this week is our friends at SmartThings and Time Magazine, of all places.
Isn't that fabulous?
Wow, big story, big spread.
It is a big story. And it's talk about great. And you wrote the thing about, because I tweeted this too, about how I was surprised. On the drive up here, I was listening to This Week in Google, and all of a sudden they start doing an ad for SmartThings. And I thought, are they doing it on multiple shows or just that one?
I don't know. I think that might have been the first one. I saw that too. And since Twit is very permissive about how their content gets used, I actually snipped that piece of video and put that on my tech blog. Yeah, I was surprised to see that. You know, SmartThings. I think they're making a big effort to amp up their visibility. I mean, they're starting to feel like they're sort of coming into their own as a company. But they're also, I would imagine, feeling pressure because there's the whole HomeKit thing
and HomeKit and Google
and the Nest, the connected to Nest thing, and they're in a weird place where they might be in a position of having to compete with Apple, but at the same time, their technology could possibly be complementary. I mean, it could actually hook into HomeKit, but it could also compete with HomeKit. They're kind of in a weird space that I've been trying to figure out, and I wanted to ask them about that. But for some reason, you know, they don't seem as eager to talk to the St. Paul Pioneer Press as they are to the Time Magazine. But what the heck?
Well, yeah, they're
don't take it personally.
You're right. Yeah,
they're spending a lot of money not only on advertising but on PR. But you know, the Wall Street Journal story kind of backfired on him because that guy said, you know, he's going to keep his dumb home for now, you know, so that particular PR reach out.
Joe Soucheray's brother, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, the guy makes the point that he thinks it's way too early. It's a geek thing.
Of course it is.
And he's right, you know, and there isn't a killer app yet that causes the mainstream to run out and do this, you know. They have programmable thermostats and, you know,
give it a while.
And I wrote about SmartThings not long ago, you know, in the heels of the HomeKit announcement. And one of the points I made in a sort of a side column to my main story was how I've used SmartThings over and over. Sometimes I use SmartThings for a while and then set it aside and then I'll come back to it. And I'll have to sort of refresh my memory about how it works and about how things hook together. And I think the point I made is every time I do that, I sort of feel like I'm taking a college course and it feels heavy. It feels complicated. It doesn't feel effortless. So SmartThings is very cool in a certain way, but it's also extremely nerdy. And it's not the sort of thing that an average person can easily embrace.
Well, let's face it. It was founded and is run by developers and geeks. And you know, they have a huge following. They've made a lot of progress. They're no doubt a huge success story for this town, even though they're really headquartered out in the D.C. area, but they still have plenty of people here. But, you know, we just keep waiting, at least I do, to see who's going to acquire them. I mean, they're an early player that's made a lot of inroads. I can't see how they can continue to be an independent company going forward unless some VC puts 50 or 100 million behind these guys and says, okay, let's throw it at marketing and go nuts, you know.
Who do you think would acquire them?
Oh, well, you know, there was talk that Apple could at one time, but I don't know. I see less and less of that as a possibility.
I see a GE or a Cisco. Yeah. I mean, GE bought Quirky of all things. Mm-hmm. And the thing about SmartThings is they're not the only ones. You know, we also have Digi in our backyard.
Yep.
And they're not the only ones that are looking at the space and saying, we're going to be protocol agnostic. So we're going to take, we're going to handle Z-Wave and Zigbee and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth LE and whatever else emerges. We don't really care. We're going to just handle it all. And the differentiator will really be who can build the tools that make it, to your point, Julio, to make it kind of a no-brainer to say, oh, I want this lamp to turn on, and then 20 seconds later, I want the one upstairs to turn on, so it looks like I'm walking up the stairs to turn on the lamp. No, but seriously, I mean, if you're not going to be home, why not have your smart things work like that?
So make it actually look like you're at home.
Make it look like there's a human turning the lights on, right?
Yeah, right.
And then I
have visions of you, you know, putting a, you know, a cutout of you on a train, like Home Alone, going in front of, and then turn on the train with my profile going by the window.
That's right. That's right. That's right. I just need some firecrackers and
yeah, exactly.
No, but seriously, I think that they're in actually a really good position. One thing I haven't really liked a lot is the fact that the hub has to talk to the server for everything, for every event, mm-hmm. and so they can log every event. Now, that's great, except if the thing goes offline for any reason. Then it's got to reboot and all of that, and twice now it's had to reboot right about the time the event was going to happen to turn on the lights in the house. So that's not a big deal, but now fast forward, think about installing this in a loved one's house who's a senior citizen, and stuff doesn't happen because the hub's offline. So these are the kinds of things that they're working on solving, you know, like have the thing work even though it's offline, you know, that kind of thing.
Battery backup is always good too.
So
and we're
so,
still and in this space, you know, quite frankly, we're still waiting for that aha moment where somebody shows us this is how to do it in a way that's obvious, that's easy to understand, and that just works. You know, like HomeKit, SmartThings has sort of made a run at it to a certain, it succeeded to a certain degree, and Apple has sort of cryptically, you know, announced HomeKit, but there isn't a whole lot of detail about how it's going to work, what the user interface is going to look like, and so forth. And at some point, we're going to get to the point, and we're all going to have that aha moment. You know, this is the way to do it, and we're not even close to being there yet.
Yeah.
Be patient.
Yeah.
Well, I should put this article in the show notes. I'll put it in the show notes about a New Scientist that had an article on the rise of robot reporters when software writes the news.
I remember that one.
Yeah, because pretty soon, Julio, you know, you're gonna have to start competing with robots. So.
Yeah. How do you guys know you're not talking to a robot right now?
That's exactly right.
That's true.
The ultimate Turing hurt.
No matter what happens, Julio, you always have a place here.
Okay.
So, you know, right next to Steve's robot.
Well, before we move on to the Supreme Court decisions, Sports Engine raised another $25 million.
Sport Engine, yeah. Speaking of VC, that was quite a surprise. I had a feeling something was coming. I know these guys. They were a client at one time, but I don't have any inside information, but this is a huge chunk, you know, probably five or six times what they've raised in any one chunk in the past. I think they had raised a total of maybe 10 up until now. But as I say, I have no inside knowledge, but I got to think this money is going to go towards acquisitions, scaling this thing up even bigger than what it is. And certainly growing the size of the staff, I suspect, as well. They're probably going to be heading towards 200 people here pretty soon. But these guys have the amateur sports market pretty well. They're pretty dominant in that space. And I suspect that they could be acquiring competitors. I don't know for sure, but who knows what else they could be doing with $25 million, spending a lot more in marketing. I would think marketing and sales. I'm sure they're going to be hiring more salespeople. So you know, that's
well, what's kind of disappointing for me is that you know I run the website for our Lakeville North Girls Basketball Association, and it's a Sport Engine template, and it's on the Sport Engine system. What's kind of disappointing is they really haven't done much as far as changing the feature set of that basic product of theirs. Hmm. It really hasn't changed much. And I'm just realizing that it's been 3 years that we've been with them. It's like, well, geez, you would think you would have some feature upgrades, like, for example, the ability to schedule, posts to come down automatically. That's probably the biggest thing that anybody has to deal with, since most people are dealing with their websites on part-time basis, to be able to say, okay, take this down, rather than, oh crap, I forgot to take that down a month later, that sort of a thing. So
you'd think they'd be doing stuff like that. That raises the question, are they working on too many other new products and not enhancing their main legacy product that
well that's
much,
a, you or? Know that's a good question, because when coming out of the content management space, I know the space pretty well, and the first time that I got a behind the scenes with Engine itself, I immediately saw all of the potential and all the opportunities they had to move into various spaces. And so they've done the absolute number one entrepreneurial smart thing, which is to focus, own one market, focus on one market and dominate it and become the player in the market. Then you can expand out. That's the one thing that I think that they're really doing with the sport marketplace. But Phil, I haven't seen it for a while. And that is kind of disconcerting that they haven't added a lot of functionality or done other sorts of things that make it more usable.
Yeah, and it's I'll be the first one to admit that maybe there's some upgrades to this system that I'm unaware of, that there's another level to move to or something like that. But again, it's one of those things that so many people are doing this on a volunteer basis that you really have to be hit over the head to say, try this out. I mean, they're adding things like event management and tournament management and that sort of a thing, which is a nice extension and a nice piece, but at the same time, you really got to refresh to keep the other stuff up to date as well. And I think that they've got a mobile app out there right now that is really not very helpful. I mean, it doesn't allow anybody to access changing things on the online via the app. It's a great viewing app, but it's not a very helpful app for the administrators and people that really have to update that stuff.
Well, maybe we should have Justin on to tell us what they're going to be doing,
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I got to tell you, as much as I can complain about it, you can't fight the fact that they've been incredibly successful. I still am very envious of the company. I think they've done a great job. I just, there's not a user in the world that doesn't bitch about something, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you said they were, getting into event management. They had that for quite a while. They had a product called Event Engine, but my understanding was they scaled that back and they aren't pursuing that event category as much as they were.
Yeah, well, it could be it's just rolled into another product, which is, this tournament management piece.
I think they're putting everything behind the brand Sport Engine, obviously, which is why they changed the name of the company to that name.
This is an extension of Sport Engine, and it integrates with your site to run tournaments and things like that your organization.
Supreme Court this week, two law technology decisions. The first one is being widely reported as police now need a warrant to search your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Although if you kind of look closer in it, there are some exceptions, and they can still look at that data without a warrant if they say it, they really need to. So, but I think, obviously this is going to affect law enforcement. And what do you guys think?
Well, it's also been, there's been... several cases that prosecutions have come up with data that only came through the NSA through warrantless searches, and so there's that concern as part of this, but also the fact that police agencies are buying more and more SWAT-like equipment, and they're also really kind of going after this space specifically, which is if the phone's on your person, we can go through it.
Yeah, and you put that Washington Post article in, which, kind of points out that your cell phone has lots of data, more data than anything else, and they can really build, you know, a lot of circumstantial evidence based upon, you know, location and other data that's on there.
Right.
Yeah, so, your entire life is on those devices.
Yeah, so it's pretty scary.
Yeah, so if your entire life is on a device, and if law enforcement has unfettered access to that device, you're looking at a very scary Big Brother kind of a situation. So to put the brakes on that a little bit is a heartening development from where I sit.
Yeah. Exactly. We'll have to all go on burners.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, yeah, but you know, I mean, well, it takes a warrant to go to AT&T or Verizon or Sprint or whomever to get a log of locations that you've been to. So if you say, no, I wasn't at that location where someone was murdered, and they go in and look at your log and say, yeah, you were, because this is when your cell phone pinged the tower and you were right there at these coordinates, that's fine, but they got to get a warrant to get that information. Yep.
Which is great. So I think every decision by the Supreme Court can be, challenged and, but it's, I think it's a good thing. Like Julio says, it's putting the brakes on it a little bit.
Yeah. Actually, the more important story of the week.
Yeah, I was going to say, no security tip this week, but you have a tip for where to keep your cell phone.
Yes, there is a study carried out by researchers at the University of Exeter in England that has suggested that men who keep their mobile phones in their trouser pockets could become less fertile. So, there's always been concern about radiation, holding your phone up to your head for too long and all of that. But regular exposure of the groin area
to mobile phones
lowers sperm quality. So, hey, just a word to the wise.
Yeah, don't bake your family jewels. Yeah,
got another
about. Case for cargo pants, baby. Get them down.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So the second is
why I wear cargo pants.
Oh yes. Yeah. Keep it away from the jewels.
So the second Supreme Court case makes Julio sad. It's this area. Looks like they're going to be shut down.
Well, we don't know. The Aereo folks are making kind of brave noises about, this isn't the end, and wait for more information. But it kind of looks like the end for this service in its present form.
Yeah, what if they did a set-top box? That I think that would be more like a TiVo, and they could get around this, couldn't they?
You know, possibly that would be a completely different business model. Their current business model is to set up data centers in each of the cities where they operate with these, tiny little dime-sized antennas by the thousands, and then rent out these antennas to their customers. That's their whole MO.
And you got to look at that, and you got to say, look, you build a business on what basically is a loophole. Yeah, you're gonna get in trouble. I mean, come on, really?
But I think
they basically said, okay, so we'll avoid paying fees because we're not providing a community-wide feed, meaning cable.
And they're not.
So we'll just, of course they're not, because they're, they're saying, okay, well, we'll just use a bunch of little tiny antennas and make money off of that.
It's a novel way to get around copyright law, but it does point out that copyright law probably needs to be amended for the internet age.
I quite honestly never thought Aero was on really solid legal footing.
They're not.
So that part I get. It was kind of a crapshoot whether they were going to prevail in the U.S. Supreme Court. The thing that bothers me has nothing to do with the legal ramifications. The thing that bothers me is I, as a consumer, want high-quality, affordable alternatives to the Comcast beast. I want to sort of get into a place. If it were just me in my household, I would have cut Comcast a long time ago. My wife is kind of hooked on it. So I want to get into a space where she is more comfortable being able to cut Comcast without a lot of pain, and Aereo is a very interesting situation because I have been using Aereo on a test basis via their New York City area data center and the New York City channels, because they never officially deployed here in the Twin Cities, so So I'm just getting Big Apple stations, but I'm basically using Aereo. And my wife is a big World Cup fanatic. And we've been watching the World Cup on Aereo because Univision, you know, the Spanish language station, is available over the air around the country and therefore by extension via Aereo. So we've been watching Univision in high definition, you know, via Aereo. And it's you can rewind it, you can record it, you can pause it. And it's been absolutely fantastic. And that's just one example of having choice and having some of those choices not be prohibitively expensive the way Comcast is. And now we find ourselves in a situation of this very interesting option being completely taken away from us. And in fact, Aereo, I think just this morning announced, we're not formally shutting down as a business, but we're for now turning off the service. So as of this weekend, my wife can't watch the World Cup on Aereo anymore. And that's sad. It makes us very sad.
Well, Julio, just leaf antenna at Best Buy.
And just for everybody keeping track at home.
The way
we say it in America is Univision.
Univision with an accent over you, please.
So Julio, here's a question for you. Actually, two questions. One is, what's the World Cup? No, I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah.
The second question, though, the serious one, is have you ever done a review of any DVR, over-the-air DVR solutions like, you know, Simple TV or Tableau?
No, but it's very interesting that you say that. Aereo, when Aereo came on the scene, I got into sort of a place in my head where, okay, these leaf antenna things are, you know, they're obsolete. They've become irrelevant. And so I sort of put them out of my head. I used to play with these little Elgato TV tuning devices that you hook up to your Mac.
Yeah.
I put that out of my head. I just basically dismissed all of that. I said, okay, Aereo's here. Don't need any of that crap anymore. Now that Aereo looks to be dead, I'm suddenly rewinding furiously, and I'm about to launch on this massive testing campaign. I already have three or four of those antennas that look like little sheets of laminated paper you hang on your window. I have several of those that I'm trying out. I've requested review units of various. I'm forgetting the names, but some of them are kind of interesting. They're actually devices where they have the port for the antenna. They have the port for your hard drive. You can hook in your internet connection, and basically, it's a device where you can DVR your over the air and also get your Netflix and so forth. So there, you mentioned a couple of those. There's a variety of DVR. There's a TiVo unit. There are a variety of these devices where you can just put them in your entertainment center, hook them up to your antenna, and sort of basically do sort of roll your own Aereo at home.
Yeah, I think the closest that I've seen is TiVo's Romeo, which does have the feature of being able to stream to your smartphone or tablet.
Yeah, so there are a variety of devices at a range of prices and at a range of geek levels. You know, some of them seem pretty consumer friendly. Some of them seem pretty nerdy. But I'm gonna try a bunch of those and to see what I think. So to answer your question, I haven't done what you're proposing, but I'm about to.
We'll look for that.
Good.
Yeah.
All right, the other big story of the week, Google I.O., all the announcements. There's a whole bunch of links that we've put in the show notes. So let's kind of go around the horn. What do you guys think is the biggest story to come out of Google I.O.?
Oh, clearly the fact that they've added drop shadows and animation and called it, material design. That's clearly the big... No, I'm
little,
sorry.
Little that's, sarc-
that
little
was my
sarc-
little sarcastic.
And, remember, I'm an Android guy. So, but that was a little bit. Oh, really, guys? Come on.
it looks good. It
looks fine.
They're going beyond what Apple's doing with some of the animations.
Yeah, I suppose. But anyway,
the bigger story with that is they're at the beginning stages of coming up with sort of a design language that is both native in the form of apps and web-based, but with a sort of a common look and feel that is intended. I'm sort of going by what they're saying, but it sounds interesting. That is intended to be to look as good on a phone and a tablet as it does on a car console, on a big screen TV. So they're coming up with this common design language that is designed to adapt to all these various screens. I think that's kind of interesting. And what I also find interesting, you know, I'm just reacting on a visceral level. Like Gmail on an Android device right now, in my opinion, looks like complete crap. It looks ugly. And I was watching the keynote and looking how the look and feel of the new version of Android is going to sort of execute, you know, these various apps such as Gmail. And I'm just reacting viscerally, but I think it looks great. It's a big leap forward in terms of elegance. Versus our friend in Cupertino. I think it's a big deal. It just looks great, I think.
Well, I think the biggest thing that came out of this is the kind of unification of Chrome, both the browser and the operating system, and Android, so that you can do Android mirroring on the Chromecast, on your Chromebooks, and actually run Android apps on a Chromebook, which kind of opens the platform up immensely.
Sure. I'm not sure why you would want to do that, but yeah.
Well, if you need an FTP program, there's a couple of online versions of FTP, but they're all crap. So there are dozens of good Android FTP apps.
Okay.
So as an example, so there's a lot of things like that and there's productivity software and other things that I think it makes the platform a lot more attractive.
Well, I thought the big one was the Android Wear.
I agree with Steve. I don't know if that was necessarily a big surprise or anything, but that was really what I was most anxious to hear about, was more about Android Wear.
Well, did you see almost every speaker at I/O had a smartwatch on?
That's something
exactly.
And yeah. They just looked enormous, especially on the women. They just like looked enormous.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. I mean, just they look kind of big. Everybody's saying, "Hey, look at these sexy thin devices that they aren't really all that big, and they're just huge." And I'm still in a place where I need to be convinced that, really, do I need this thing strapped to my wrist? Do I really need that? Like, for instance, I have a Pebble, and I'm constantly re-persuading myself to use it. Like, I'll use it for a few days, and then I'll set it on my nightstand and sort of forget about it, and the link to the phone will get cut off, and I'll look at it and, do I really want to use it? And I keep trying to force myself to use it, and it's useful up to a point, but not to the point where I really like having this device on my wrist that's sort of interfering with, you know, with my long sleeve work shirt. And these devices that were demonstrated at Google I/O are several orders of magnitude more sophisticated in terms of their UI and their capabilities than a Pebble. Granted, but still, I'm still not convinced that this is something that I really want or need.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Yeah,
and if men think they're clunky, women are a totally different, have a totally different opinion. I mean, they want really tiny stuff. I heard a woman speak about.
Wait a minute, that's not what I've heard.
Healthcare, well, in certain things. But I heard at a healthcare event recently, a woman discussing with another woman a device, or actually the CEO of a company that has a wearable healthcare, you know, kind of a device that would be like a pendant. And she was objecting that it's a little big, you know, and she pointed to what she was wearing around her neck, which was this tiny little fine chain with a little charm on the end of it. And it's like, you know, when you can make them this small, then I'll get interested. You know what I mean? They aren't even interested in wearing a large pendant, some of them. And
but, you know,
wearing a large watch, I mean, I don't see many women doing that. I really don't.
Well, you know, the funny thing is the other day I pulled an original iPod that I have sitting in a drawer out of and showed it to my daughter, because she had one of the first ones. And she goes, "Oh, my God, Dad, I totally forgot how gigantic that was."
Yeah.
And
heavy as well.
Yeah. So when I think about wearables and I think about smartwatches and all that, it's hard for me, because I'm sure it's hard for all of us now. We have our expectations are so high that is going to be the, it's just going to nail the sweet spot of where the product needs to come out. But I keep looking at this and saying, yeah, it's a 1.0.
It is, and it's going to take years for it to mature, and maybe it won't ever, because there, you know, there are only some applications like that, all the health monitoring stuff, that kind of makes sense in that form factor.
Yeah.
And unless you're going to replace your smartphone with a watch, I just don't see it becoming anything but a kind of a, you know, a geek kind of a thing.
Yeah, an add-on that, yeah. You know, that we all have to go and buy because it's the latest thing, you know.
We have to wait and see what Apple does, obviously, and they might shoot this out of the park. But based on what Google showed, you know, I just saw a lot of tech writers saying, sort of trying to convince themselves that this is really awesome, and sort of saying, hey, it's not that small. Oh, it's not that thick. And, you know, it really is.
It is.
Well, Julio, you haven't seen some of the watches that are fashionable now. Probably dwarf that thing.
Have you guys seen the Withings? I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this correctly. The Withings watch. Withings is a company that makes a variety of smart consumer gadgets, but they came out with a watch that looks like a fine Swiss timepiece. It looks like a regular watch, but it has a lot of smart capabilities built in. It's a completely different approach in look and feel to the ones that were announced at Google I.O.
Are you speaking of the Activité watch?
Yeah, and I haven't used it, so I'm just going with what I'm looking at on the webpage here, but that looks like a nice watch. I can't really say the same thing about the ones I saw at Google I.O.
Well, you know, I'm surprised that this came out afterwards. I just put two links in the show notes at the bottom of the Google thing. Somebody else put in that Google announced Drive for Work with unlimited storage at $10 a month.
Yeah, it's got an invite.
For Google Apps.
Invite to that yesterday, yeah.
I think that's incredible.
It is. Yeah, unlimited storage, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, because I'm constantly stressed out about whether I'm going to max out my my online storage on Dropbox or Google or OneDrive and so forth. It's a constant source of stress. I have to keep checking to see which of the like when you buy a device, you get a 2-year bump in storage. I have to constantly check to see which of those offers that I signed up for a couple of years ago are about to expire and cause my storage allocation to plummet.
Julio?
Yeah.
You need a hug.
Julio needs a hug. Somebody get Julio a hug, stat.
He got a lot of storage.
Yeah. So if I can pay my $10 and not worry about that anymore, I think I'm all over that.
Yeah. Hey, we should probably wrap up, but someone put in that today is a 7-year anniversary of the iPhone.
Actually, I believe it's the 29th, but the day it went on sale, 7 years. Do you believe it's been 7 years? Wow. And you're seeing stories with the photos posted of, what the San Francisco store looked like on that day. I'm trying to remember what it was like here in Minneapolis, but I don't think I went to the store on the first day. Did you guys?
Yeah, there was a big line at the Mall of America store. Now
I was in Barcelona when it came out.
Ooh, did they have a store there?
It wasn't on sale in Spain, so it was only sale in the U.S.
I went Saturday morning because I couldn't do the line on Friday. I just didn't have time, and was really concerned that I was going to miss out on the first one, but I got one.
Well, I got mine because I was with DoApp at the time, and everybody got them. You know, we had a pre-order in or whatever, and all 7 or 8 of us got them, and it was amazing. It changed the world. I mean,
what apps was DoApp building when the phone came out? Before the phone came out,
well, they were getting ready to. The SDK didn't come until months later, though. The app, the SDK to build apps.
It was 6 months later, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because remember that Steve Jobs was trying to convince everyone that web apps were the way to go?
Yeah.
Oh, it's interesting. Right. There's a series on Debug by one of the original iPhone developer heads. It's a three-part series, and it's like 4.5 hours in total. But he was going in and telling some incredible stories about how, you know, internally at that time, they figured out that web apps weren't the way to go, that native apps were much better, much more responsive, and that Jobs was actually 360 degrees the opposite direction internally, saying we've got to support native apps. But at the same time, externally, he's saying, oh, these great web apps, this develop those.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is web apps are perfectly fine today, but obviously we have, you know, faster internet speeds, more sophisticated mobile operating systems. Yeah, I'm amazed at the extent to which I've completely stopped using native apps. I'm talking primarily about the desktop, but almost, you know, 90-95% of what I do on a desktop computer right now is web-based, and that includes things like Mailplane and TweetDeck, which, you know, are nominally considered native apps, but they're basically wrappers for web content. There's a calendar app called Sunrise, for instance, that's totally web-based. Along those lines, you may have heard that Apple is gonna stick a knife in Aperture. And switch over to a more web-based
and iPhoto too
model, and I'm finding that all very interesting because it sort of lines up with my behavior in recent years. I keep retiring native apps on the desktop, and it's fine. The web apps are great.
So Julio, do you guys at the Pioneer Press, do you write in Google Docs?
That's a slightly complicated question to answer. Some of us do. Not everybody does. A lot of people still compose in Word, and then there's a little keyboard command to sort of send the story to the editor. A lot of people still do that. But some of the geekier among us at the paper, like myself, for instance, we write in Google Doc. I write in Google Docs, and I share. I just do a standard Google Docs share with my editor. And he edits in Google Docs, and then when we both agree that the story is fine, and very often we're working on the story at the same time. When we both agree, okay, it's done, then he switches, then he moves the text over to the content management system. So some of us are doing that. In fact, I started doing that a long time ago. I was the first at the paper by a long shot to do that. At a certain point, I just got sick of Word and that whole thing. And I just, without telling my editor anything, I just switched over to Google Docs and started filing my stories that way. And I was like, for a month or so, I was like stressed out because I was wondering if she was going to come and say, no, that's not how you do it. You have to do it this way. And to her credit, you know, she never said a word.
Does that change the writing process if you're actually sharing your column or whatever story you're writing with your editor and they could kind of edit in real time?
I don't know that it changes anything. It just makes things more seamless and collaborative and easy. If I wrote a story a particular way and then my editor said, no, you have to make some changes, that whole conversation used to be very clunky. But now we're both living in Google Docs, and it's great. It's absolutely fantastic. And in fact, I'm doing things now that would have seemed inconceivable in the past. Like, for instance, I do this selectively because, you know, sometimes sources I deal with for stories are control freaks and you don't want to give them an opening. But with people that I trust, with people that I interview for stories who I trust, I'll say, okay, I'm done writing the story here. I'm going to share it with you in Google Docs. Look it over, make sure I got it right. I'm doing that more and more. That would have been unthinkable years ago. And I'm doing that. And in fact, on a couple of occasions with sources that I really, really trust, I've even said, here, I'm going to share this with you now. Watch me write the story. And as I'm writing the story, tell me if I got anything wrong. And so I'll be writing the story, and the guy will be watching me write the story, and he'll go, bloop, nope, no, you got that wrong. You might want to reword that.
Real time, wow.
And it makes sense. In the Google Docs world, it makes sense, but at the same time, it's kind of mind-blowing. I never would have done that before. In fact, I used to be stressed out about showing stories you know, very early in my career, I had a couple of really, really stressful situations where I showed a story to a source who then got really control freaky and tried to take over the process. And that kind of scarred my psyche to the point where for decades, I never, ever showed a story to a source ever again. But now I'm circling back and realizing in 99% of the cases, it's fine. And it actually makes for better, more accurate stories. What the hell?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Do you still wear your fedora?
Hell yeah. I had one commissioned. I had one commissioned to look like the one that Steve Borish did, you know, with the cover art with the Superman.
Lois Lane.
Yeah. I went to Hatmaker and said, I want a fedora that looks like that.
All right, we should probably look at events. I guess new stuff is our friends at Ministar announced Mini Demo and two of them at the same time. That's kind of new.
They haven't done that before. One July 14th, July 31st, and then another one September 11th. So bam, bam.
Yeah.
And coming up next week, a mini hour for community supporters and sponsors. Darn, I'm going to miss that. Because I'm going to be up north, but that's just a small gathering. It'll be about 75 or 100, I suppose. But yeah, two mini demos, July and September.
Huh.
So anything else?
EduCelerate on July 10th, which is a meetup identifying transformative opportunities in edutech.
Yep, and then Phil, Mobile Twin Cities.
Mobile Twin Cities was moving to the second Monday of every month. At Coco downtown, sponsored by our friends at the Google for Entrepreneurs. So that
July
means
14th.
That means they pick up the tab on food and drink. So we love them for that.
Is that an evening event, I assume?
Yes, it is. Yep. 6 in the evening, yep.
Cool. Yeah, and then the big cybersecurity summit in October, where the world will converge on Minneapolis to talk cyber security stuff.
Featuring Steve Borish.
That's right.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Nice. Well,
very good.
It's been a good show.
So, yeah, lots of stuff to talk about, and there'll be more next week on
the Minivate Gang podcast. Yeah.
Take care, boys.
Have a good week.
See you guys.
See ya.
Everyone I choose, still somehow in each forever, I know.